Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of May. We're going to be talking about the primaries. Florida, as you know, members of the Florida legislature have now scheduled Florida's presidential primary for January 29 of next year. Now they used to have their primary in March, so now only the Iowa caucuses on January 14, the Nevada caucus on January 19, January 22nd, New Hampshire primary would come ahead of Florida. South Carolina is also scheduled for January 29, but they are talking about moving up their primary, so they'd be the first primary in the South. And New Hampshire is also threatening to move up theirs maybe to a date this year. Some analysts have said that the primaries are way too early, that the presidential race has become a two-year slog, and it's hard to imagine anybody who benefits other than the people who earn a living raising money and managing campaigns and the big people who are courted for contributions. As of now, 22 states will be holding their primaries or caucuses on February 5th or moving toward doing so. But there's also, and this will be interesting to learn about, there are penalties for states who move their primaries earlier than February 5. We'll be talking about that and talking about this front loading of the primaries. Our guest this hour believes that it's not a terrific idea. Professor Alexander Lamis is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. He is a specialist on elections and political parties, the author of The Two-Party South, also Southern Politics in the 1990s, editor of Ohio Politics. His research interests include American government and politics, elections and political parties, public opinion, judicial politics, and comparative constitutional law. We'll be welcoming phone calls from Professor Lamis. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Professor Lamis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
Hi. So what's going on? Why do they keep moving up and moving up and moving up? Do states get a lot of money from all these people, all the candidates in the hotel rooms get money, or is it something else? It's getting ridiculous.
Well, I don't think it's so much the money that they get from the campaigns, but the states that go early love the attention. And, of course, New Hampshire and Iowa, for some decades now, have fought to keep their first-in-the-nation status. But the process overall is seriously flawed, and I would have said that and did say it, in fact, the last cycle, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening now actually has some hopeful signs in it for future change, because as you mentioned in your summary, the whole thing has become very chaotic this year.
Tell me, I wasn't aware of this. What are these penalties that states will face? I understand they'll lose delegates here, and I don't know what this all means if they move their primaries.
The national parties in convention, have the right to deny voting privileges to the delegation or cut it back to, say, half of what it would have gotten otherwise. But that doesn't seem to be bothering Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But the national parties have set February 5th as the start of the main events after the initial contest.
And why is it that states would not be worried about losing half their delegates? It seems to me as though that's a pretty big thing.
Well, the way the nomination selection process has gone in recent decades, what happens at the convention really isn't very significant, because the nominee is chosen in these contests months beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So Florida, for example, says we want to be in on the choosing, and we want candidates to come to Florida and address our issues. I heard, in fact, the Speaker of the Florida House, who's one of the leaders in this, I heard him on television saying we don't care to be part of a window dressing in August. We want to have a say in January. But I think what you need to recognize is that the Democrats this cycle took the lead to break the monopoly of Iowa and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first big break in the system. They put the Nevada caucuses in between Iowa and New Hampshire, and then they let South Carolina come a week after New Hampshire. And that really begins the process. Now, the people who fought for that change really wanted to go much farther. Carl Levin was a leader, the Democratic senator from Michigan, and he said, well, you know, I even have a quote here from him when he got through the minor reform. He said, I hope it's the beginning of the end of the privileged position of Iowa and New Hampshire. Hmm. It's a crack in the wall which New Hampshire and Iowa have built around their privilege. I think the wall sooner or later will come tumbling down, and it should. Senator Levin said, and I agree with him completely. There's no reason why Iowa and New Hampshire should always be first and have the focus on them. It's not to say that there's anything wrong with those states, and in fact, their voters and caucus goers take the process very seriously. And it isn't a good idea to have smaller states go first. But I think we could have another process that would be fairer to all the other states.
Right. Well, they're hardly representative of the makeup of the American population, right? There are very few minorities in both of those states. There aren't many big cities.
That's right. In fact, that was the argument for putting Nevada and South Carolina up front, that Nevada has, I think, 23% of the state is made up of Hispanics. And, of course, South Carolina, being a deep South state, has a very large African-American population, you know, close to 30%.
Mm-hmm. So why is it, Professor Lamas, that we allowed Iowa and New Hampshire to have so much clout for so long?
Well, it happened gradually as the old nomination process disintegrated. And when I say old process, we have to go back 100 years, even farther, to see how we nominated presidents then. In essence, the decision-making was made at the convention. And the selection of delegates didn't involve many rank-and-file citizens. The party leaders tended to tightly control the selection process. So when you got to a convention, say the convention that nominated Franklin Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson in 1912, there's a lot of bargaining went on among party notables who control state delegations for who would be the president. Now, we moved away from that in a gradual process in the 40s and the 50s and into the 60s, and primaries became an important selection process for delegates to the convention. But it really wasn't until after the 1968 Democratic Convention, that debacle in Chicago, that the parties really went about widely opening up the process.
Mm-hmm.
And as they did that and made the primaries the place that was important for candidates to secure the nomination before the convention, states saw that it made more sense to go first if they could. So there's been this jockeying to go first, and that's led to this front-loading process that we've seen over the last few cycles. But this year is just, as you pointed out in the beginning, it's just gone crazy with 22 states now jockeying to be in there on February 5th.
Right. And New Hampshire saying, I think this is amazing. Well, they obviously want their position. We may have to have this in 2007. Oh, no.
Yeah. That is crazy. And that's why I say there's a hopeful sign in all this, because it's so ludicrous to start that early, if it comes to that, that I think there will be a major consideration after this process is over in 2008 for how we go about having a more sensible plan. In fact, I shared with you and your staff a plan that my wife and I came up with and published back in the 2004 cycle.
A backloading plan rather than front-loading, right?
Yeah, an effort to space the process out over 4 months. Our plan is to have about 15% of the delegates selected in the first month, and then 25 in the second, 25 in the third, and then finally 35 in the fourth month, and to choose the states through a lottery process that would involve regions shifting who would get to go first through lottery, and then states vying for early slots, with the emphasis in the plan to put some of the smaller states first in the lottery. So that you would keep that advantage that Iowa and New Hampshire have now, which is that there is some good retail politicking going on, which makes the advantages of money in the campaign less significant.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that considering how many states now you have holding their primaries or caucuses February 5th or before, that it's really going to stretch these candidates. They all want the candidates to come and speak with them one-on-one. But you can't do California and South Carolina and Iowa and Florida and all of these states in a very short period of time.
Exactly. And so, you know, what we're looking at now on February the 5th is really our first national primary.
Right, yes.
And, you know, now people have proposed a national primary as a solution to this process. And, you know, personally, I don't favor a national primary. I'd prefer the system I mentioned or even a system of regional primaries.
Mm-hmm.
But that may be, you know, one of the ways we end up.
Mm-hmm. There also has been evidently, it's hard to figure out where everybody's going to be by next January or next February, but there has been speculation that for the Republicans and for the Democrats, none of them will do well enough to get the whole thing wrapped up on February 5 because they all have different strengths, and so the vote could split quite a bit, and that means that you're going to have perhaps a sustained struggle to win a majority of the delegates. What do you think?
Well, I think that is a possibility, and you know, one reason that I also see the change that is occurring this time in a hopeful light is that by pushing it all so close to the early contest, that is having those possibly 22 states voting just a couple of weeks after the process starts. You're not going to have the winnowing of candidates that has occurred in other cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that winnowing that is really at the heart of the problem with this. In other words, candidates who don't do well in Iowa and New Hampshire tend to drop out. And so the voters who come later in these other states don't have the opportunity to view the full field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, that's what really bothers, I think what really has bothered a lot of people is that voters and, you know, maybe some cycles, 70% of the voters have had no meaningful choice. You know, there will be a primary, delegates would be chosen, but the nominee has been selected weeks, if not months earlier.
Mm-hmm. Is that true, though, Professor Lehman, is considering the fact that these people have been on the road now, they've already been on the road and we're way... They were almost a year before the primaries and caucuses.
Well, that's a good point. In fact, I think that's different this year than it was even last time in 2004. We're getting more public attention on the process because of the media, for one, as well as voters who follow these things, realize that it's going to happen so quickly this time, or it could happen so quickly after February 5th.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scenario that you mentioned that. There are a lot of splits and no one or two candidates arise may very well happen, and the thing will then go forward. I think Wisconsin actually is several weeks after February 5th. I'm not sure the exact date, but
I'm not sure either. Actually,
yeah, it's not as far as I know. Wisconsin hasn't moved to February 5th or talked about it.
No.
But that the Wisconsin primary could be important. It was important the last cycle, as I remember. I think Howard Dean made his last stand in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and then lost, mm-hmm. to Kerry.
And John Edwards did very well in Wisconsin too. It kind of kept him alive. Some.
That's right. And then, but the whole thing was pretty much over in mm-hmm. early March last time. And see, each cycle now it has been ending earlier and earlier. But because the states have taken the actions that they have, they are in a sense saying to the grand architect of the process, but there is no such person. But they're saying we want to get in on it, and we are going to get on it. We're
right.
going to see that our citizens have a voice, and because of this, as I said earlier, I think we might really have big change coming after the process.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Alexander Lamis. We're checking on the date of the primary here, too, so we'll let you know that. He's an associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University, a specialist on elections and political parties, author of The Two-Party South and Southern Politics in the 1990s, editor of Ohio Politics, and he has come up with a different plan for these primaries and caucuses, instead of front-loading them, back-loading them some, which he briefly outlined and can talk more about during the course of our conversation. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Do you like the way things are progressing here? Do you like the front loading? Do you think that this is a good way for all of us to be able to select the candidates, or does it leave out the American public? What does it do in terms of, you know, one-to-one at the local diner, meeting your candidates, or does it spread them pretty thin here with so many primaries and caucuses taking place right at the beginning of next year, and perhaps even New Hampshire before the beginning of next year, which I find amazing. We'll take your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a couple things to let you know about. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about honeybees, which seem to be disappearing all over the United States, in South America, and also in Europe. And it's created, scientists can't quite figure out why. And it's created a great deal of concern. We will talk about that. And while we're talking politics this hour, just a reminder that, well, maybe you didn't even know this, so it's not a reminder. Maybe you're hearing it for the first time. Elizabeth Edwards will be joining us for part of our show tomorrow, the second hour of the program. She'll be with us about 10:30. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Alex Lamus. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Robert from La Crosse is our first caller. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Well, this is a wonderful proposal, and I don't know what any objections could be about it, but maybe you have some ideas there. My question actually started with the previous guest, and it's still relevant. Just the context, Harry Reid seemed to be trying to put the best face on a vote that he was not happy with. He had to make it sound like maybe it was sort of a victory or a compromise. Why didn't he just say, we had to compromise and fall back and look for another time when perhaps more Republicans would join us? Why don't the Democrats treat the American voting public like they might be able to understand these things? And don't the Democrats bear some responsibility for the fact that the voting public is still so unsophisticated in general? Apart from the listeners to this show, who really does understand this all that well? So I think this is relevant also to the current question. Hopefully the public's going to be better educated because the process could be changed in a way that might involve more people instead of sitting back and waiting for Iowa and New Hampshire to speak. But that's it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Professor Lewis. Yeah, it's yours now.
Yes. I think Robert made a fine point, and there's just an enormous amount of interest, of course, in the Iraq War. It's the overriding question of our politics today, and will be throughout the campaign. The problem that the Democrats face in Congress, of course, is their alternative to what they're doing now, compromising, is to bring the government to a standstill. That is not fund the war effort, and they're very reluctant to do that. I mean, the fallout from something like that is just politically could be politically disastrous.
Thanks, Robert, very much for your call. Let's go next to Paul from Cumberland. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I'm wondering if it would be possible to change the order that the states have their primaries and caucuses each election cycle. I would think that would be really dynamic.
Well, exactly. In fact, the plan that my wife Renee and I came up with does exactly that, and we say that there should be a lottery at the previous convention, the convention before the next cycle, determining the order, and it would be done by region, and then within region by states.
And then the order would change each cycle, or each?
Exactly. You could win the lottery. You know, perhaps. I mean, people could tinker with the mechanism, but you could set the cycle for the next four times. Let's say, so that the four regions would alternate, and maybe the Midwest would go first if it won the lottery, and then within the Midwest, you would have some of the small states going first, something like that. But at any rate, the idea of spacing it out, I think, has a lot of appeal to people who have become frustrated with the rapid way it has gone in the past and the winnowing process, leaving voters in most states with little choice.
Yeah, that way then different regional issues could get touched on each different cycle, and things would change each time, and it would be exciting.
And, right, and other voters, you know, particularly in the beginning, would have a choice. I have a quote here from Michael Dukakis, who won the Democratic nomination in 1988, and he was a guest at a national symposium on this whole problem with the nomination process. It was in 2001 at the University of Virginia, and here's what he said. He said, "I spent 85 campaign days in the state of Iowa alone in 1988. Now, Iowa is a great state, and I mean that, and they did very well by Mike Dukakis, but 85 full days campaigning in one state, folks, really doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense, does it?"
No. Anything else, Paul?
No, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, I might just add that Howard Dean, in 2000, gave an interview in a Canadian broadcast outlet in which he criticized Iowa, saying that basically what Dukakis said, that, you know, Iowa's a fine state, but why should it always be first? And that was revealed, you may remember,
yes,
in 2004. Mm-hmm. And while I didn't track it closely, my hunch is that was the beginning of Howard Dean's decline, mm-hmm, when the Iowa voters said, oh, my God, he doesn't respect us.
Now, you've come up with this plan. I am a little bit – it seems that those states have the control here. Who would make this recommendation? And I assume it would just be a recommendation. The DNC, the RNC would say, here's what we think you ought to do, but ultimately it's up to the states, right?
No, not really.
No.
The national parties, when they meet in convention, are the main governing body of their organizations, and they have full power to do what they want. So the national parties in convention, and of course this would be considered by committees before presented to the convention, have the power to say this is the way it will be, and if you don't follow our this process, you can't attend the convention.
Oh.
And, you know, not only not use the sanction that's been mentioned this year, saying you're going to lose delegates, just say you can't send your delegation.
Hmm.
That's one way it could be done. The other way it could be done is by Congress taking action. Congress has the power to do this.
Oh, they do?
Sure.
And have they walked into this water before? Have they made recommendations, Congress?
No, I think Congress has been reluctant to, you know, to engage in it. But I'm sure, you know, Senator Levin is interested enough to introduce legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Legislation may have been introduced. I don't know, but it certainly hasn't gotten a lot of support if it had been.
Wisconsin's primary, by the way, is February 19. We tracked it down. So let's go next to Paul. Thanks for the call. Chris from Green Bay. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is a fascinating topic to discuss, and it's really important. And I think we're at a dangerous position here because a decision has to be made to establish a new system that actually stays put. But I am afraid that this system, like so many things in our country, is going to get hijacked by big money. And that means, in this case, by the big states, when the national parties come together to establish a new system. And somehow or other, we need to make certain that the process always starts off with small states, because otherwise, you know, what are named marginal candidates, you know, Ron Paul or Huckabee or any smaller candidate who's not well-funded doesn't have a chance if the process is going to start off with states like Florida or California.
Mm-hmm. Professor
Lynch. You might have mentioned Jimmy Carter in 1976.
Right.
I mean, he basically moved to Iowa and got his big boost when he won the Iowa caucuses.
Mm-hmm. John Edwards is basically moved there now, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks, Zach, very much for the call. Our number, we have some lines open now if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. I've read reports, Professor Lamas, that because we have so many now of these primaries being so front-loaded that a number of the candidates are just not going to do local advertising. They're talking about just national ads now. That's interesting.
Well that is, and the campaigns are certainly – reacting quickly to the changing environment. I mean, they have to. But as your last caller, you know, suggested, the the earlier you have a lot of large states, it does give the edge to the better known candidates like Senator Clinton and others, John McCain, and those who have been able to attract a lot of good funding.
Mm-hmm.
And the candidates who are not well known at this moment are going to have a tough time unless they can break through in the early states.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of them will be dropping out before these primaries and caucuses?
Well, that's what we'll have to see as it unfolds. But it I don't know. I mean, I hope they don't. Frankly, I mean, mm-hmm. The winnowing process is just disturbing. If you think that you could be president and you have people who are going to support you and you have a message, I think you should stay in and not be, you know, not be scared off, say, in September because you don't have anything near the money of Senator Clinton or Senator Obama or Mitt Romney.
Right. Thanks, Zach. Is it Zach? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Zach, hello?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Zach from Green Bay. Go ahead.
Yes, I my comment basically agrees with the previous caller, but I hate being cynical all the time, but I keep finding reasons to be cynical, and that is, you know, why it is that not only large states are now going to be early, but also these large groupings of states, which does nothing but benefit corporate money and large moneyed interest, which is absolutely detrimental to the process and detrimental to the Democratic Party. And I just can't help but be cynical that there were powers that be that had this in mind and this was done on purpose.
I mean, my feeling is that no one is directing this. That self-interest has directed the front loading.
Mm-hmm.
That the various states, for understandable reasons, have moved their primaries forward to let their voters have a voice. Now, when we come to large states, as we were saying earlier, the people without a lot of money are disadvantaged. But that may not, I mean, we think that's a conventional wisdom. It may not be the way it works out this time because there may be a lot of debates among the candidates. It may attract, you know, big audiences in these states. You know, people may take it upon themselves, and with February 5th fast approaching, that they need to be informed about these candidates, the way the Iowa voters and Iowa caucus goers and New Hampshire voters have always been.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they won't get to meet the candidates in small groups the way it happens in Iowa and New Hampshire, they may get a lot of free air coverage through these debates.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting, and it took a certain amount of nerve for the governor of the state of Florida to say that Florida will now take its rightful place near the front of the line in determining the next leader of the free world. And my immediate thought was, I hope you got your voting stuff straightened out down there, Governor. I guess they do. I don't know.
Well, I heard also the Speaker of the House, I think his name was Marco Rubio, and he was arguing, well, what this is going to cause is all these candidates to come to Florida to address of special interest to the Florida voters,
mm-hmm.
and he listed some things, and a lot of those issues sounded to me, frankly, like issues that would be of interest to Ohio voters and Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
voters
mm-hmm.
and other voters.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has their, you know, their own state prejudices.
What are you hearing from the candidates about all of this? Are they just going with the flow? Are they objecting to this front loading?
Well, I don't think we'll get a candid, response from candidates. Most of them say, I protect the prerogatives of Iowa and New Hampshire and now the new prerogatives of Nevada and South Carolina because they don't want to offend these early voters. But I don't know. I mean, I would like to see a candid statement like Howard Dean made in 2000.
Right.
But it came back to hurt him, I think. So I don't think we're going to find the candor among the candidates. Maybe after it's over, you can panel a whole group of them and let them take it apart, the process. In fact, they would be very good witnesses for
a good idea.
Yeah, a reform effort.
We're welcoming phone calls for Professor Alexander Lamis. He's an associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University, a specialist on elections and political parties. And we're talking about the front-running of the primaries and the caucuses. It keeps getting earlier and earlier. The latest, Florida, where members of the legislature scheduled their presidential primary for January 29 of next year. And then we've got, they used to be in March. Now we've got only the Iowa caucuses on January 14, Nevada caucus on January 19, January 22nd, the New Hampshire primary, and then South Carolina would be scheduled for the same day as January 29, same day as Florida. What about these primaries? What about the fact that they're coming so early right now and that this presidential race is going on for 2 years? We then now have February 5, 22 states holding their primaries or caucuses. Should there be a different system here? Should Iowa and New Hampshire have the amount of clout that they have right now? Does it make sense for states to try and get in first so that they can determine the next leader of the free world? Do we need another kind of system? Do you feel, as a voter, that you're involved in helping to select the candidate, or do you feel left out of the whole process? We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Our guest has outlined another way for us to select our candidates, a different kind of process over 4 months. Some smaller states be involved early on. And we do 15% of the states the first month, and then the second and third and fourth. And so we're looking at how we nominate our presidential candidates this hour. Join us if you'd like, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, honey is crucial to agriculture in this country and throughout the world. Albert Einstein said that if honeybees became extinct, human society would follow in 4 years. We're all connected here. The nation's honeybees are in trouble. Scientists and beekeepers noticed a strange die-off last year, and now the syndrome, which is called colony collapse disorder, has spread to nearly half the states and is responsible for killing as many as 90% of the hives in some places. Europe is also giving similar reports. The scientists aren't sure what's happening here, but it's important that they find out what is happening. We'll be talking the second hour of our program about the colony collapse disorder. All right, back to phone calls as we look at the primary caucus system. All the states, you know, seem to be wanting to be first in line here. And as a result, we're getting the process started in January, early in January. New Hampshire, who really wants to continue its tradition, even talking about having their primary in, 2007, why not? Professor Alexander Lamis is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, and our next call is Steve. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
Say, I'm getting more and more concerned about the amount of money that we're throwing around in these elections. It just seems like the process gets longer and longer and longer every year, and I really think that your idea would help mitigate some of this cost. I mean, the regional idea, especially if the smaller states go first. The other advantage that I see is that it would also really increase voter participation if other regions have some say in it on the process. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, I agree completely with the concern about the amount of money that's being spent and how it's being raised and all of that. And in fact, what hasn't gotten a lot of attention this cycle is the fact that a number of the major candidates are staying out of the public funding process that Congress set
right,
up after
yeah.
the Watergate scandal.
Yeah.
This is, I think this is really a scandal. I mean, we had a system in place of public funding of presidential campaigns, the primary campaigns, as well as the post-convention general election campaign, and it's rapidly unraveling. I think we ought to fix that too. that, you know, that, I mean, that's a complicated subject we can't just jump right into, but it is, you know, it's clearly something that ought to be looked at.
Yeah.
Well, some of the candidates are taking, you know, the public route and are engaged in getting their money that they raise matched by taxpayer money.
But not any of the big names, not any of the likely nominees.
No, Senator Clinton stayed out of it, and, mm-hmm. And others. I think, well, I think Senator Obama took the position that he would come back into the public funding of the general election if the Republican candidate would do it too.
Mm-hmm.
But that, like I said, there hasn't been a lot of attention to this aspect of it. So I think your caller is exactly right that that's another. Element of this. I mean, the reason we're so concerned about this whole question is, of course, the presidency is such a powerful office.
Mm-hmm.
It's become this way over a number of decades now, and it's vital to our democracy, and we want to see it chosen in an intelligent fashion.
Right, right. And it's also got to be, you got to weed out people who may consider running just because of how difficult a process this is. These people have other jobs for the most part, and here they are, traveling all over the country 2 years before an election.
Yeah, it's grueling.
Ugh.
And it, you know, if you go back and read some of Theodore White's books, The Making of the President, 1960, 64, 68, you'll see it was pretty grueling back then, too. It was just a different, you know, it was a different process. And, of course, it didn't start as early.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say it really does put the candidates through a severe test,
mm-hmm.
Even as we have it now.
But
I don't think there's anything wrong with people trying to improve on a system. After all, I mean, we're a great democracy, but we can be better, and we should concentrate on improving our democratic processes.
Steve, thanks for the call. Let's go to Carol next from Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I agree totally with your guest. And I'm an Iowan, and so I get to participate in the caucuses, and it's just a ball. But you know, let's pass this thing around. Let's give some other people an opportunity to be courted like we are. And I thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Do your neighbors feel the same way, Carol, or are you?
Oh, I haven't talked to anybody this morning.
Oh.
But I'm willing to speak my mind.
Uh-huh. So. Well, it's very generous of you, isn't it, Professor Lamas?
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, I have in front of me my favorite Herblock campaign on this subject, cartoon on this subject. It has a man sitting on top of a mountain, and he has a cap on labeled NH for New Hampshire, and then the caption says, "Oh, all wise and powerful one, tell me who you'll allow me to vote for this year," with the public down below the mountain looking up.
That's a good one. Thanks, Carol, for the call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. So has anybody picked up on your proposal for change here, Professor Lamas?
No.
No?
But I'm not alone. I mean, there are a number of people who've proposed all sorts of things. And Senator Levin, probably the most prominent. And you know, he would be the, you know, a good person to, you know, to talk to about this, and somebody who really, you know, can generate interest at the highest level.
Right. But it looks as though it's going to continue, although maybe now with everybody moving things up so early that maybe now people are realizing this system has to change.
Right. I mean, but, you know, as I said early on, despite the chaotic nature of what's happening this year, I think this is a much better development than what we had over the last few cycles, because it does at least potentially allow roughly 65 million voters to have a voice on February the 5th.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even though we see problems with that, that's an improvement. But of course, people then step back and say, well, those who were not part of the process, the later states, they'll say, well, why aren't we part of it? And then maybe a lot of people just look at the problem and say, we really should
do something about it.
Give me a little history here, because I need it, Professor Lemus. When did things change? I can remember when delegates to the convention were very important and decisions were made at the convention. When and how and why did that change?
That's right. It did not change in any one election year. It's been a gradual process away from letting the convention be the main source. Early in the 20th century, we started some states started opening up the process of selecting delegates to the convention by primaries, and then that has grown. In fact, Wisconsin was a leader in that whole process, and that has grown gradually. But it really, you look back at even the 1960 nomination fight. You had several major candidates who did not enter any primaries, but went to the convention trying to win that nomination. Lyndon Johnson was one. Stuart Symington was another. Now, Kennedy went into the primaries, and he defeated Hubert Humphrey in several contests, and Humphrey dropped out, and then Kennedy did amass enough delegates to win at the convention. But it was still an open question when the convention met. There was always the possibility that Kennedy would not secure the simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really after 68, because there was such an uproar over the way delegates were selected, and of course there was a lot of dissatisfaction with what happened at the convention, that the McGovern-Fraser Committee was appointed and looked at the whole process. And so in 1972, you had the most primary-dependent selection process. And in fact, the architect of the new process, Senator McGovern, went on to win the nomination in 72. It was the beginning, but it didn't change, completely. And then there have been different processes that have or different changes that have come in recent years. For example, the addition of the superdelegates. There was a feeling in the 80s that we had left the party establishment out of the process. It was too open to voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have roughly 20% of the Democratic convention, at any rate, being made up of what we call superdelegates, people who get to be voting delegates based on their position in the parties in their states.
Mm-hmm. So
and, in fact, if it is a close contest all the way to the end, the superdelegates could be the determining factor.
Yeah. And they tend to be legislators and governors and...
Yes, and party people who've worked in the parties, the party chairs.
Mm-hmm.
There are all sorts of mechanisms for selecting them. But that if it did come to that, that you had, three or four candidates battling right to the end, nobody had a majority when the process was over, and the superdelegates chose the nominee, there'd probably be a backlash against that, because the superdelegates, of course, don't get their position based on voters at the time of the selection process.
Yeah. William from Madison is next. Hi, William.
Hi, Kathleen. The thing I wanted to point out is that in each state, each candidate has to have so many signatures to get on the ballot. And it can vary. I know in Illinois it took 25,000 signatures, and sometimes you only have a couple of months to get them on the ballot. And so I think a lot of the public doesn't realize how extensive this is, and varying from state to state. Some states, I don't know what it is in Wisconsin, but this may be why some of the candidates are acting now or declaring their candidacy. I think that the Democrats, or the Republicans that are well-known candidates, maybe they don't have to go through this process. I wanted to find out if that's the case, because I know for a third party, you have to have all these various signatures, and a lot of times they don't get on the ballot in all the states. So could your guest comment on that?
Yes. As you pointed out, it is complicated. Every state makes its own arrangements, but the campaigns have to put people out front who will be the delegates, and then they are selected through whatever the process is, and it varies so much that every campaign has got to have several people who do nothing but study the rules and make sure that they're prepared properly for the ballot in each of the states. Mm-hmm. And some states still, you know, select through the caucus process, which is even more complicated and is spaced out within that state over a matter of several months, going through a series of conventions, starting at the precinct level and then building up week after week till you finally have a state convention that selects the delegates. That's really the old-fashioned process, plus a lot of more popular participation than you had 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anything else? Still, I'm concerned about when do they have to start getting signatures to get on the ballot as a candidate? At what process in the whole mechanism? I mean, do they have to start now if they declare their candidacy, you know, on public? Do they start getting signatures now?
Well, there'll be a deadline in every state when you have to meet all the specifications for having so many delegates, having signatures, paying fees, and all of that. And, you know, the one thing about our federal system, it makes it very difficult to ever make a general statement about the way all 50 states do it. And so there would be a lot of variation, and the campaigns simply have to follow that closely. And that would hurt, you know, candidates who don't have a lot of resources to put people on that.
Well, it takes a lot of footwork on the part of people supporting them to get those signatures, and so they have. I know in Illinois there was only a 2-month period to get 25,000 signatures. I was doing that back in 1990 for a candidate that was on the Populist Party ticket, James Bo Greitz, and we got him on the ballot. We had 52,000 signatures in 2 months. So, and he couldn't even get on public. We got on public radio, but he couldn't get on public television. They blocked him out. He was a war hero from Vietnam, most decorated Special Forces commander. But we managed to get him on, but he couldn't get on in all the other states either. So that makes it difficult for a third party to get in.
Absolutely. The third parties have a very difficult time. I mean, just go back and look at some of the more prominent third-party candidates like Ralph Nader and others who had to fight their way on the ballot in a number of states.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, William, for your call. Let's go to Elizabeth next from Eau Claire. Hi, Elizabeth.
I just had a quick question, and I'm on my cell phone, so I hope you can hear me.
Sure.
If it's a real close call as far as delegates go, won't those states that have their primaries last get a lot of attention?
Mm-hmm. Sure they will.
Absolutely. And there, you know, there of course are some. I think just looking at a listing here, I see that Kentucky, South Dakota, Indiana, West Virginia, are all way back.
How far back? What are the latest ones?
Well, the graph I have shows that they're 4 months after the Iowa caucus.
Oh my gosh!
And Montana right now is actually dead last. Of course, it'll be, you know, quite a coup for those states who didn't rush to the front if they become the center of attention.
Mm-hmm. Which could happen, considering what's going on, as we said earlier.
But it's unlikely, frankly.
Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth, for the call. Stan is next. Hi, Stan.
Stan?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. First of all, I agree with the commentator concerning his idea. I like his idea about the primaries. And my questions are two. One, how could that idea be put on a ballot that could be voted by the American people, one? And number two, I know we have a program right now of electoral college votes as far as electing the president, but is there any reason we could not adjust that to where he's just elected purely by popular vote? And I'd be interested in his thoughts on those.
You're absolutely right on both counts. We could have, in fact, constitutional amendments that address both questions. But it's more likely that the nomination process would just be decided by Congress. You don't really need a constitutional amendment. To change the Electoral College, however, you would need a constitutional amendment. And, you know, this has been debated for a long time, and there are a lot of people who agree with your caller's position. In fact, I was a little surprised that after 2000,
when Al Gore won half a million votes more than George Bush, that there wasn't a greater outcry for popular election of president.
Thanks so much, Dan, for your call. And Professor Lamas, thank you very much for a lively hour. Thanks. Professor Alexander Lamas, he's an associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. And we were looking at the primaries and, well, the latest news that the state of Florida has decided that they would move up their primary, saying that Florida should have a rightful place in being a leader here in determining who the next leader of the free world was going to be. So they moved theirs up to January 29, which means that we've got the caucus in Iowa on January 14, the Nevada caucus on the 19th, January 22nd, the New Hampshire primary, but they may change theirs to be even earlier, and then South Carolina and Florida both scheduled for January 29. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. We have news ahead and we'll return to talk about honeybees. Stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.